Consumer Reports names the 2014 Chevrolet Impala as the greatest thing since sliced bread. Bentley does what everyone expected them to do. And Mercedes-Benz clearly has way too much time on their hands. Coming up next on another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 204 for July 26, 2013. Cadillac goes to twin turbo heaven.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Welcome, everybody. We're back. It's Thursday, somewhere in time. And joining me on another episode of Autoline After Hours is Mr. Todd Lassa from Automobile. Welcome, Todd.
Peter, good to be here.
And Scott Burgess from Motor Trend. Scott, always good to see you.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And, you know, another big week of news. Let's see, what do we have to talk about? What about Consumer Reports and the naming the Impala the top pick in sedans?
I think that was quite a surprise. I mean, the car is good. It's I have to keep in mind that it's a Consumer Reports pick. From an automobile point of view, it's a good car, but not as exciting to us as it maybe is to them. But it's very well done. You know, it's a front-wheel drive car. It's on the same platform as the Cadillac XTS and the Buick LaCrosse. And I think the pick actually might that's troublesome for Buick is that Consumer Reports talked about how much luxury it has and how it how they compared it with even the Jaguar was the XF and the Audi A6, which I think was a little bit hyperbole on their part. I mean, it's a good car that stands up to the competition well, but what does that mean for the Buick LaCrosse?
Yeah, you know, I like the Impala, but I don't know. With Consumer Reports, every once in a while, they just seem to go off the deep end. I don't know. What do you think, Scott?
It's a really nice car.
Yeah, nice car. I like it.
I was surprised by the score. I think it was a 95.
95 out of 100, yes.
And so, I mean, that's Model S territory, isn't it? I mean, wasn't that the 100 out of 100 not that long ago?
Yeah.
And
well, there's more hyperbole. I mean, the Tesla Model S is very good, but is it perfect? I don't think so.
It's worth three Impalas. But I also
for three Impalas.
For three Impalas.
But it's that large car segment seems to be a shrinking segment anyway. People are moving away from it, and those are really big cars. I mean, 20 years ago, there was a segment shift. You know, the midsize cars were large cars. The midsize cars are actually compact cars. So the large cars today are pretty big.
And I have to say that I've been impressed since Chrysler introduced the 8-speed automatic and the 300, the rear-wheel drive competitor for the Chevy Impala and the, right. the Buick LaCrosse that gets 30, well, it's EPA rated, though. Let's not say it gets 31 miles a gallon, but it's EPA rated 31 miles per gallon on the highway with that 8-speed. So there's pretty good competition there.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like I said, I like the Impala. I think it's a well-done car by GM. The true believers of GM really, pull all the stops out. But you bring up a good point. What does it mean for the LaCrosse? And, I always, it's just me personally, I always take everything Consumer Reports says with a grain of 400-pound sand. And especially after the Tesla thing, I just said, the Tesla is a nicely executed piece, but it's not a 100-point anything.
Right.
So what do you guys think of Daimler's AMG division getting a piece of Aston Martin? I think it's just a matter of time before Daimler owns Aston Martin.
Oh, no question. I mean, look at it this way. It'll save Aston Martin.
Yes, it will.
you know, Ford tried that for how many years? And I think it's probably a better fit. It's certainly a better fit than Ford and Aston Martin, and it's certainly a better fit than Mercedes and Chrysler. So
yes, it is.
You know, it's a small company. It can be absorbed within Mercedes.
And when you read the release and you say they're going to use the powertrains, and you could just see the Mercedes powertrains that will fit nicely in the Astons.
Right.
What does it do for AMG, the Mercedes side of the AMGs?
That's a good point. I mean, what's going to happen to all the SL variants they have, and you know, which is direct competitor with the Aston Martin? I don't know what's going to happen there.
If you look at the way AMG has spread out, if you will, the way it's diversified in the last several years, and now there's, you know, the next one, the next big one is the small one, the CLA 45 AMG.
Yeah.
They figure they've got the room to do all that. And so I think they're probably figuring the Aston. Remember, this is an infinitesimally small company in terms of its volume and makes... An SL AMG look like a volume car.
Yeah.
The other thing about Mercedes-Benz, and I don't think this is a bad strategy necessarily, is that, you know, their main competitor is BMW and also Audi. BMW has always had more of a sporty characteristic. The true Mercedes-Benz are not sporty cars, but Mercedes AMGs can be sporty cars. So they can sell a Mercedes to people who just want a good stately kind of luxury car. And then the AMG has the sporty variant, and then you take that one step further with an Aston Martin.
I will say this about Aston Martin. Boy, they get a lot of, they make a lot of noise for a small company.
All you need is James Bond.
Yeah.
That's all it takes.
And their chief is always good for a few quotes and colorful.
Yeah, he is. He's a very interesting guy.
We should have a shout out for a previous guest on this show. Hao Taitang has just been named Global Purchasing Chief for Ford, which I think was a significant move for the company, and I think a good move. I mean, Hao is one of the brightest guys I've ever met in the business.
Ford seems to be kind of mid-shuffle right now. We're seeing a lot of people rotate around. I mean, some of it's very insider baseball, but you're like, wow, there's a lot of people kind of shifting around. So
I mean, even to the average enthusiast, the head of purchasing is like, huh? But it doesn't matter, but... It does matter to the...
It's huge, and you think of a year and a half ago now, or a little bit, about a year and a half ago when Derek Cusack suddenly stepped down as the product and engineering chief, and Ford replaced him with Raj Nair.
Yeah.
A lot of people were expecting, or thought afterwards at least, that, wait, what happened to Hao Taitang? He'd spent 4 or 5 years down in Brazil.
Yeah.
Came back about a year or two before the Cusack stepped down. And
ran SVT at one point.
Yeah. But what he was doing was learning the kind of the business side of it. He's got an engineering background. He earned an MBA somewhere along the way. And I've already speculated as the Motor City blog man that at automobilemag.com. I'll put in one more. Here's another little... There's our latest cover.
The new
C7? New
C7. You can...
Speculated that, when Mark Field steps into Ellen Mulally's shoes, someone's going to have to replace Mark Fields. And I would submit that Hao Taitang would be a pretty good choice there.
Well, we'll see. When Mark does ascend, that job might go away, actually.
That's true. Mm. That's true.
So, let's see. Bentley announced the obvious. They're going to make the gargantuan SUV that they showed in Geneva. I hope they take a finer pen to the design, but...
bad news for you. Our own George Cocker, who our European correspondent, who actually had the story just before the Bentley announcement.
He's like 7'5".
7'5", and...
what are these, 6'7"?
I don't know. I think he's 6'7", or 6'8".
Yeah.
6'6", maybe. Anyway, he...
That's it, right? We have it on screen. That's it, huh?
He tends... Well, he reports that the Falcon, the concept clinicked better than anybody thought. So now they've gone back to working on that design. Is that the final design? I'm sure it's not quite the final design, but... at Clinic well, so.
Well, you know, let's face it. I mean, when they showed it, everyone, you know, they said, well, we're exploring the possible, you know, of course they were going to do it.
Yeah.
It's always the number one selling vehicle for any of those super high-end vehicles in the U.S. You know, the Cayenne came across, and, I mean, it outsells all the other Porsches combined nearly.
Yeah, I admit, I decried the Cayenne, and then, you know, obviously the profits from the Cayenne allowed them to do a bunch of other stuff, but, you know, there's no point in fighting it. That's just the way it is. I mean, people love crossovers and SUV crossover, whatever. They just like them.
Right.
Bentley has really big goals. Bentley wants to be at 15, 16,000 units a year worldwide in a relatively quick span as, you know, part of BMW's, or not BMW, I'm sorry, VW's.
VW Group, yeah.
Yeah, plan to rule the world, yeah.
And they're only at, I think, 8,000 worldwide. So they have to double their sales, and this will be the volume vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing about, you mentioned VW Group, is that with so many brands in its group, you could logically say that, well, Porsche would be a sports car company, but, of course, that Pandora's box was opened before it was fully engulfed into VW Group. You could say Bentley could be you know, luxury sedans and fast coupes, and Lamborghini could just be exotic Italian supercars, because we've got other divisions who can sell you a really nice loaded kind of sport utility vehicle. But, you know, when you sell so many of them under all of those brands, and then you say, well, you know, how much money does each $65,000 Audi Q7 make for VW Group? And then you say, well, okay, throw in a few thousand dollars more in really nice wood, really nice leather, a few more electronic gizmos, and then sell it for $200,000.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the price point is.
Yeah.
Because Audi, Audi is the most profitable. Audi and Porsche are the two most profitable divisions in the Volkswagen empire. One thing that's happening lately, which I take as a bad sign and for the business, is the increase in 72-month financing. I mean, here we are in a cycle where, let's face it, profits are up, booming sales. That follows, I'm afraid it always is followed by short-term thinking in the executive suites of these car companies, especially in the U.S. And, you know, the 72-month, that long financing, I mean, it just gives me a sinking feeling that...
Well, we were tired of, as a group, the Americans were tired of only being underwater with their houses.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to also be underwater with whatever we have in our driveway.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, cautionary tale out there. If you're contemplating a 72-month loan, just keep walking. Don't do it for your own health. And go ahead.
I was going to say, is the basic car becoming a luxury? I mean, I read someplace that statistic, maybe you know this number or not, or a different number, that something like 30% of car buyers buy new cars as opposed to used cars. And I'm sure that number is going down and has been going down. You've got the luxury brands. You know, everybody wants a luxury car. And the luxury brands have these pre-owned programs, certified programs, and they're selling, you know, I've got a lot of people buying used Audis or BMWs instead of a new Chevy or Ford. And
well, then there's always the vast wasteland of near luxury, my favorite segment. But
I've been near luxury before myself, never quite there.
Speaking of car manufacturers with too much time on their hands, Mercedes graced us with the Vision golf cart this week. And, hey, you know, I love when car companies let, you know, do blue sky stuff, and it happens all the time. Some of it's really good, some of it's not so good. But really? This golf cart thing? I couldn't believe Mercedes did a huge release on it and everything. It's probably going to be at Pebble Beach, knowing them. I just had to laugh.
You know, if Mercedes had held on to Chrysler, remember Chrysler used to sponsor the Bob Hope Show, and this is for us old timers, obviously. And Bob Hope had a golf cart with his
right.
his face on it.
And they also had the golf tournament, which has morphed into something else. But I'm sure there's a tie up in there somewhere. So, what are you guys driving lately? What are you driving, Scott?
I'm driving a RAV4 right now.
Really?
It'll be the least exciting week I've had at all month. It's, you know, I mean, I honestly think that Toyota is on an experiment to see how much they can decontent vehicles and people not get upset. Yeah. And then next year, decontent it a little bit more, take a little bit more away, make the dash a little cheaper. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of like following the Oldsmobile game plan. And it's just disappointing that car after car that when I get into it, you're just like, wow, this is just sad and depressing. Especially when you get into something like a Mazda and you're like, wow, this is very nice.
Well, but those Toyotas, they sure do run forever. I guess that's selling.
Reliability is obviously more important than soft touch points.
Yeah. But you're right. They're going to dumb it down to the point. There is a point of diminishing return there. They're liable to find it somewhere. What about you? You just drove the 4 Series.
I hate to say because I drove the BMW 4 Series on the long lead, I found it. When I drove the 3 Series for the first time about a year ago, I thought we talked about how there's this kind of layer of isolation that BMW has kind of added, and the 4 Series, the car that they presented at least to all journalists worldwide on this. Kind of global launch that went on for a week or two, all the same spec, all the 435i with the 3-liter bi-turbo i6 and 8-speed automatic and the sport package, and even the same color. They're all silver with a red and black interior. Very nice, felt very, you know, the thing was so calm and well-sorted that my co-driver, who I've co-driven with on a lot of BMW trips, said to me, did you feel like you're driving as fast as usual? And I said, no, I felt like I drove slower on the first twisty course. It was one of those trips where we get off the plane, we get in the car. It was overseas, get off the plane, get in the car and drive through part of Portugal automatically. And so I was a little bit more, I thought I was being more careful. And my co-driver said, no, it felt like you were going about the same speed as usual. So so that tells you something about the car, I think.
Is it quite a bit different in feel from the regular 3 Series?
I wouldn't say quite a bit different in feel, no. I think it is, I think it's the way this particular car was set up, the fact that it had the sport package, not the luxury package. The car is, they have added a, what's the, they've changed the suspension a little bit. They've lowered the car. The car is lower than the previous 3 Series coupe. And it's lower than the 3 Series sedan, the current one. It's a little bit more planted.
How's it look in the flesh? I mean, I don't go by auto shows anymore because the light's weird, and you don't really know until you see them out on the road.
Yeah, well, in German car silver, which is the color, I thought it looks good. I thought it looked like actually maybe a better proportioned 6 Series. But that said, our design critic Robert Cumberford is much less kind to it than I am.
I like Robert. He's a curmudgeon, but he is.
And he can...
He's a stickler. He's good.
He is. He says what he thinks, and he's pretty critical. Yeah, exactly. and I drove up in, I had Scott's job until late last year, and being the Detroit bureau, I would trade cars with Frank Marcus, and we'd each have a car for about a week. Now at Automobile, I get into a different car every 2 days, and I hate to say this after your mentioning, and I know you saw what I drove up in. I've got the red Nissan GTR out there.
I was going to ask about it.
565 horsepower.
What do you think of that car? I don't like the way it looks.
Yeah.
I've made no secret of that, but it seems like it would be heavy and feel heavy.
It makes you a good driver. It makes you think you're a good driver, I guess, is a better way to put it.
That's always dangerous, though.
Yeah, it is. And it does, this one's the track package is particularly stiff.
Which is really great for our roads.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not my favorite sports car by any means. I understand it. I understand that the younger buyer really likes it. It's a little bit of a video game on wheels with better feedback than a video game. But still, not the sports car I'd buy.
Well, before we take a break, show us that cover again. I guess the C7 first.
Didn't bring the motor track.
See, there you go. Well, there it is.
The C7 first driving impressions are out. They're not really full road tests, are they?
They're not full. Well, no, we've got...
pretty good numbers.
Yeah, we got numbers, yeah. And actually with the help of my old colleague, Frank Marcus, who was there. Ezra Dyer wrote this story for us. I was present for this shoot at Gingerman Raceway, which happened after the drive.
Which, for those out there, is a track in southwest Michigan.
Yeah, about 1.8 miles, I think.
Yeah.
And was able, the great thing about that is spending all day on the photo shoot was I was able to drive several of these cars, including, you can't tell, but I'm behind the wheel of the 427 C2.
Nice.
Yeah.
I actually, you explained that you didn't have the good sunlight and all that for the shoot. I actually like it better.
It worked well.
I looked at the pictures online, and I thought it looked better with overcast than it normally would.
We liked that. We didn't because it was still raining and storming at sunup. We didn't get the sunup shot, but we also didn't get the high sun at high noon, and so that's when we got some of our best shots.
Yeah, and you can shoot all day. You know what? We're going to take a break right now and bring up our special guest, but in the meantime, we're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Well, we're back. We're going to welcome our special guest, Mr. Rich Bartlett, one of GM's true believers. He's the assistant chief engineer on the new high-feature twin-turbo V6 that the company is releasing shortly. Rich, welcome.
Thanks for the introduction, Peter.
And our viewers probably saw the giant engine on stage before I made the introduction, but that is the new engine in question. That's the twin-turbo V6 that it's going to have its first application in the new CTS. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is our new twin-turbo V6. We're going to offer this in the Cadillac XTS starting this summer.
Oh, and then the CTS.
And then we'll offer it in the Cadillac CTS, the new 2014 CTS model, fall this year. In the XTS, this comes as a transverse mount configuration, all-wheel drive with a 6-speed transmission. And we rated that at 410 horsepower, SAE rating, and 369 foot-pounds of torque. And we rated that torque on a torque band basis from 1,900 to 5,600 flat. So in that application, it'll push that vehicle from a rest to 60 miles an hour in about 5.5 seconds.
And in the CTS, it's going to be a longitudinal application?
Yeah, it looks like this in the CTS, mated to our new 8-speed transmission. And in this application, we rated that at 420 horsepower, 430 foot-pounds of torque. Lots of torque extension associated with the 8-speed transmission on this. And in that vehicle, we shave almost a second off the 0 to 60 time on that.
But the CTS is lighter, right?
Lighter car, yeah. More torque extension, closer range gear set on the 8-speed adds up to a faster vehicle.
Will that be both rear-wheel drive and all-wheel drive on the CTS?
On the CTS, rear-wheel drive only is what we're going
rear-wheel
with.
Rear-wheel drive only.
Okay. XTS is rear-wheel, all-wheel then.
No, that's the front drive car.
Front drive.
All-wheel drive only, right?
Yeah,
front.
XTS, all-wheel drive only with, bit, 500 newton meters of torque, 300.
Yeah, otherwise.
A little bit of torque steer with that.
You've got to keep it all on four wheels, yeah. But with the balance on the CTS, which is about a 50-50 weight balance, we can put it all to the rear wheels as well.
So what are the high points? I mean, this is... You start with the GM high feature V6 that used to exist, but then you obviously do a bunch to it. What are the high points?
So this engine was really introduced back in 2008 in the CTS, and then we improved that in 2010 with an integrated exhaust manifold, different fuel system, some other improvements to take some mass and packaging out. We lost about 7 pounds of mass with the integrated exhaust manifold on this engine. 2012, we took the displacement from a 3-liter to a 3.6, same architecture. And now in 14, we do a twin turbo variant off that engine. So 60-degree V, kept, you know, the crankshaft, bore positions, valve centers, all the same. So we can build on that validation, that legacy of that product, but more than 90% new parts to do the twin turbo. Lots of work to the block, of course.
So it's all aluminum?
All aluminum sandcast precision block. Provisions to get oil and coolant in and out of the turbochargers. These bearings spin at about 175,000 RPM. Got to have oil, much like a crankshaft does. So some adaptations there. But lots of changes to the ventilation system. Can't underestimate what goes on with forced induction. Blow-by gases that get by the rings are higher. You have to deal with that and balance that pressure top to bottom of the engine. So tweaks to the block. We call it puffy block. We blew it out a little bit to help this thing breathe bay to bay and drop out the oil so this thing breathes well. Of course, lots of work to the pistons to deal with the increased cylinder pressures. The biggest piece there was a steel ring insert up on the top land, again, just for structure and strength. The turbochargers, of course, are the obvious change to the engine. Tried to pick the smallest frame possible but still meet the power requirements for this engine. So there we're looking at two smaller turbochargers that we can pack tightly in this engine. Space was a big driver for this engine. When we look at other benchmark products like the BMW and the 5 Series, say, their 4.4 liter, I think, puts out about 400 horsepower here as well. Trying to put this into the new CTS where the hood lines are getting lower, you're trying to get lighter, space and mass efficiency are paramount when you're trying to do this. So that drove the selection of what we have here, and you can see how tightly we brought these in.
Well, plus it's a double overhead cam motor, which, you know, is bigger anyway. So you had your work cut out. Now, what were your goals, really? I mean, obviously, throttle response, performance, but probably performance in all kinds of driving. And then what about fuel efficiency?
Yeah, all weighed in, but the main objective was performance. I mean, this was going to be targeted for the CTS in this V-Sport category that we're now picking up. So, you know, fuel efficiency, you can deal with other powertrains to better manage that. This had to be something special that you could take on the track and be pleased with. So to do that, torque response is a big deal. When you boost an engine, turbo lag is always something you have to be concerned about. So we took provisions on the charge air cooling system here to do the best we could from a torque response. And there we built on the architecture that you see with the 6.2-liter LSA engine, the supercharged engine, where you have an inner cooler associated with a supercharger. We built on that in this architecture where we have the coolers now mounted in the intake system. So with that, we took about 60% of the compressed air routing that you typically would see with an air-to-air heat exchanger and now have a very short path up the side of the engine into the intercooler. That dramatically improves the torque response of the engine. Also really helps with packaging. You know, on turbocharged engines, you're running a compressor from the exhaust gas, basically, right?
Right.
And you squeeze that gas, take it to a higher pressure. The old chemistry guys remember the ideal gas law, right? When the constant volume pressure goes up, temperature goes up with it, and you have to cool that. We're up at 135°C when we come out of the compressor here. You got to take that down to somewhere around 45-50°C. That helps promote good combustion, but it also is important to take the density of that air down so you get more power out of that engine. This architecture, we think, did the best job to satisfy, to balance all that.
So, Rich, there is a substitute for cubic inches. I mean, you mentioned the BMW engine, which is a V8, and you're making better horsepower, about the same horsepower.
You're just talking about the old adage, there's no practical substitute for cubic inches.
Yeah, yeah. So to what specific features would you attribute that to? Are you running a lot more boost? How did you get that?
Right.
How did you beat the BMW?
It's boost pressure, right? You size the compressors to get to a certain torque, and we can extensively use analytical tools to predict what we think we need to do from a boost pressure standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then that drives the architecture through the rest of the engine of where you have to strengthen it to deal with that. This engine can go up to 12 PSI boost to make that power torque.
Okay, that's what it will run in optimum form.
It varies based on altitude as well, right? When the barometric pressure drops as you climb higher and higher, you can counteract for that with the compressors here to keep that torque in as long as you can. So the boost pressure can actually get above 12 PSI as you climb, but then there's limitations on turbine speed and things like that you have to be aware about.
Yeah, I remember the old turbo era in Formula One in the 80s, the higher altitude tracks.
All the way on and all the way off.
Yeah.
With those turbos, the throttle response was nothing, and then OMG.
One of the things we see with turbos, and turbos originally were performance-oriented, and then we saw this big spate of turbos coming in that were this promise of fuel efficiency because the engine would be acting lower, but I don't know if that promise is really being met as well as it could be. On an engine like this, how often is that turbo spinning up, forcing more fuel and things down, and how often are you driving just on 6 regular cylinders?
Yeah, Scott, that's a good point, and we should be clear with this. This is not a downsize boost application where you're trying to eke fuel economy out of a heavier vehicle, right?
This is a performance.
Yeah, and so it's built to do that.
It's all boost, no eco.
If you put it into a different category, you could ecoize it, perhaps, right, for lack of a better term there, right? But in the products it's going, clearly we're not taking advantage of a downsize boost, and that was the going in position.
Well, I mean, and also, we've all driven turbo motors. When you've got your foot in it, they're not really about fuel economy.
That's where the eco goes away.
Yeah, I mean, you can drive like you've got an egg between your foot and the accelerator, but it doesn't really...
Well, they're great cafe engines.
Yeah.
Right, and the point I'm making is that turbos were originally designed for power.
Yeah.
And that's what this one is designed for. So...
Well, the applications in the V-Sport and the XTS... Now, is the XTS going to have a special designation with this engine, or is it just an option...
It's an option.
So that won't be called V-Sport in the XTS?
I don't know if they've made a final determination on where XTS is going to go with that yet. Yeah,
we can't talk about future products at this time.
They're showing us a future product.
Now they're showing a future engine. What about the 8-speed gearbox? I mean, that's something that...
Will that be first application we'll see?
This is a first for Cadillac with an 8-speed, right? And so we got a wider ratio spread on this gearbox. We went to a 6.71 gear ratio from a 6.02, I think, is where the 6-speed was previously. That allows you lots of things. I mean, we make 400 horsepower at 5,000 RPM, and we pretty much stay kind of ISO power from 5,000 RPM to redline, which is 6,500 on this. When I say ISO power, 400-plus through that whole range. With a close-range gear set like this, when you go through your watt upshifts, now you're shifting right in that power band as you go from the 1-2, 2-3, 3-4, and so you get this really nice exhilarating push through that whole watt acceleration. That's a nice attribute about a close-range gear set. The other nice thing, of course, is the fuel economy. We do get about 1.5% better because of the gear set. We can take the final drive down where it was a 327 final drive on the 6-speed to a 285, what it is here. And that translates into about a 15% engine speed reduction cruising down the highway at 70 miles an hour. And then you can, of course, quickly change to a different ratio to get the torque back where you want it. So wide ratio is really what this transmission does for us.
But it helps, basically you're saying it helps mitigate the, help me understand, it helps mitigate the turbo lag, basically?
No, you just go faster, right? Because as you get through these gears right in that power band, this car just accelerates nicely. Where if you had a wider ratio spread and your engine speed dropped down to, say, 4,500, now you're out of that peak power band, you got to dig back out of that hole. And that's that feel that you get as you work through the gears. With this, it just feels like a rocket as it goes through all the gears, and you get a very consistent push all the way through the accelerator.
The twin turbos, right, on this, is that to three into three, or is that?
It's an integrated exhaust manifold, so the three comes to one before it even goes into the turbine housing, right? And it's an even fired engine, so they come every 240 degrees apart, right? So it's 135 on the odd bank and 246 on the even bank. Yeah, so it's nicely spaced to complement the turbine energy you're trying to recover on.
And the twin turbo, that's really where we've seen that drop in lag, where you don't have that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Smaller frames spool up quicker. 3.6 liter obviously helps with the launch of the vehicle as well, so you can rely on the naturally aspirated piece fill in the hole while the turbos activate. And here, it's seamless as you go through that watt. You know, one thing you pointed out earlier, Peter, you said in previous turbochargers that weren't executed so well, you get this discrete torque bump as you do that. And we've executed what's called vacuum-actuated wastegates. You see them on some premium vehicles where you can control the wastegate position now with an independent vacuum source. Hmm. Earlier turbochargers used the compressor pressure itself to control the actuator, so you really only had control of that wastegate when you were in boost mode. That can make those transitions pretty discrete. You can feel them. Vacuum actuation allows that precise control at any speed load. So our ability to get the wastegate in the right position to meet the torque demand is much improved with this architecture. Cost you a little more money, but in a premium package like this, it's worth it.
So this should be a pretty nice package in the new CTS, which is lighter by, I forget the number, is it 300 pounds?
Mm, is it that much? Might be.
Yeah, I think that's what they were going for.
Okay. Yeah.
Slightly bigger, but lighter.
Right.
Yeah, longer, lower, leaner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to differentiate from the ATS.
Well, and I'm thinking this really cuts out the work for the V-Series guys, doesn't it? I mean...
They can't talk about more. Future product, but if I were making an ATS V, I pretty much think that this motor would end up in it.
Right, but what about the next CTS-V? It's going to have to be even more, you know.
Yeah, well...
Mid-engine. Mm-hmm. CTS-V.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's... Cadillac's most distinctive products to enthusiasts, of course, are the V-Series cars.
Right.
And to the CTS-V Coupe is, as everyone knows, one of my favorite top 10 cars you can buy. Yeah. So, you know, it's good to see the momentum going. But, you know, every time I look at these modern engines, man, it's complicated.
That's for sure.
It is. It's a lot of parts.
So it's
better you work on it than we work on it.
So generally, it's the high points, the aluminum block, direct fuel injection, double overhead cam, four valves per cylinder, twin turbo. I mean, when you read that litany of stuff, remember, you know, 15 years ago, that was supercar stuff.
10 years ago.
Yeah. Now, you know, all these manufacturers are doing amazing things.
How many iterations are there of the 3.6 now?
Is it normally aspirated one?
Yeah, we started in 2008
with the 3.6.
It was a 3.6 in
the
CTS.
Okay, right?
And then we did a 3-liter in 2010.
That was based on that 3.6.
Off a very similar architecture. Mm-hmm. And then we did a 3.6 in 2012 off that architecture.
The direct injection.
Direct inject, right. And we still offer the 3-liter. It's more of a global play where displacement is a big tax driver for registration.
Sure.
And then now we built this. So we've really got three unique engines off this one architecture right now that's out in production.
So, Rich, give me an idea of from conception to sitting here, how long does it take to do something like this for people out there who might not be in the business, but you know, generally, how long does it take to develop an engine like this?
Right. Oh no, it's a good question. And this one, we moved quickly. We did this in two build phases. You know, you have maturity of your hardware that we put into build phases, and you learn from one build phase to the other. But this one, we spent more time in analysis. Where we're just dialing in analytically what we think the components need to do and be to get it right. And that takes more time, but...
So in other words, you'd spend a lot of time in the computer before you do anything?
Exactly. Takes more time through that phase, but saves you lots of headaches later when you learn in hardware that things weren't right.
If I remember correctly, you know, you guys use so much computer-assisted things now. The accuracy of those computers have just gone up and up. Now, did you have that same thing with this where the computer modeling showed you within a couple of horsepower what it would be?
Absolutely, Scott. I mean, it amazed me, the prediction that we could do. Power is pretty clear. We can estimate that pretty well, and I think we have been. But the combustion metrics on this thing was the piece that really is impressive. We did a lot of porting work in that head to get the mixture motion right for that chamber. With forced induction, I mean, the air is coming in quick, and you got to figure out what to do with it. And you have to time that right with the DI events so you don't make soot and all these other negative attributes. And the analytical tools are very powerful to get that right. So we hit the ground running out of that analysis work with our chamber. There were no tweaks with our chamber from our first build phase to what you see here today, which I think is a real testament.
So what is it, like 18 months, 24 months?
Yeah, this whole thing is probably in the 36-month, three-year type range here, Peter. I mean,
it's a lot of work.
Yeah, give or take some time there. But that's where we're at. And part of that, again, is we're building off an architecture that we know and love, you know, so the validation of that 60-degree architecture, you can start with that basis and then adapt to this, right? That helps to accelerate that.
So the 8-speed was easier?
Yeah,
I still don't know how.
How did the 8-speed? Was that development pretty much in parallel with the engine, or?
Well, this 8-speed is manufactured by Eisen, right? So we leveraged their capabilities. We did some unique adaptations to deal with the torque output here. So we got stronger clutches, hardened gear sets on it, a unique torque converter to deal with the twin turbo. But we were able to leverage quickly with Eisen and partner up with them on this package.
And clearly, considering where the competition has already gone, this is a transmission that you need to get into more products pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about, beside the obvious thing, which is great power and better acceleration and so on, how does this engine change the nature of the new CTS? And I know, you know, we haven't driven it yet, but how does it change the nature, the kind of flavor of the car versus the naturally aspirated 3.6? Obviously, it's a luxury car first, and then a sport sedan.
I think from an integration standpoint, you're going to see the V Sport in the CTS unique from other offerings in this thing on several reasons. I mean, there's a unique ride and handling package that's going to come with that as well. Electronic limited rear differential is going to come with that as well for stability. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to be surprised at how quiet this engine can be and how easy it is to drive part throttle, because it feels like a nice, quiet, naturally aspirated V6 for all your part throttle work. And then how quick it moves with 40-millimeter push of the foot, that it turns into something really exciting. So that, I think, is going to be a big differentiator from what you're used to seeing in previous.
And what's the difference in weight between this engine and naturally aspirated 3.6 for the new CTS?
Where is that classified?
I think we are out at 320 horsepower on the naturally aspirated version.
Weight, though.
Weight difference. Yeah, it's a good question. I honestly don't know how that's going to differentiate.
80 pounds more.
You're making that up.
I'm looking at it.
You're looking at it, and you're determining it's 80 pounds.
You know, this is a good point for us to take a break, and then we're going to take some. We'll take some questions from our viewers and listeners in rapid fire. But for now, let's get a message from our friends at Hyundai.
I can do this. This
one. The sedan.
Coupe?
Yes. Nope.
The GT is nice.
Yeah. I can't figure out which.
An easy decision just got harder.
What's happening?
Sorry about that. The Elantra. Now also available in Coupe and GT.
Oh boy.
From Hyundai.
All right, Ben, it's time for rapid fire. Are we going to run that?
Tens of thousands on the ground.
Tens, at least.
All right, here we are. Ben, we've got a couple phone calls. Why don't we start with a question from Bridgeport about this engine?
Yeah, this is Roger calling from Fairfield, Connecticut. Could you ask your guest how they're addressing the carboning of the intake valves on these direct injection engines? I see Audi's got a major problem with it, and I just wondered how General Motors is handling that. Thanks a lot. Great show.
Without hearing it, you have to answer.
Yeah, Ben, we need a little more volume. We could barely hear that.
Yeah. I heard something about direct injection.
Yeah, this is Roger calling from Fairfield, Connecticut. Could you ask your guest how they're addressing the carboning of the intake valves on these direct injection engines? I see Audi's got a major problem with it, and I just wondered how General Motors is handling that. Thanks a lot. Great show.
Carbon buildup on the intake valves?
Yeah, so this engine obviously isn't out in production, but we do have direct inject engines with similar architecture out today, right? Carbon buildup is always something you got to be cognizant of. There is a small overlap phase in the exhaust and intake timing that allows some fuel to get up into the intake and clean those valves. So that's how we manage keeping the valves clean as you move from PFI engines down to direct inject engines.
Okay. Ben, let's take the call from Hackensack.
Hi, this is Jonathan Brown out in New Jersey. We were discussing on GM Inside News Forum the twin-turbo V6 for the Cadillac CTS, and we were wondering, you know, what the weight of the engine is compared to, say, an LT1 Corvette or an LS3 V8 engine. Also, what kind of horsepower and torque rating it has at, like, 1,000 RPMs. I don't know. They said something like the LT1 makes more torque than a Porsche 911 does at 1,000 RPMs. How does this little V6 compare? Thank you very much. Can't wait to test drive the new Cadillac twin-turbo CTS. Have a good night.
Yeah. Mass on this one is 211 kilograms. I've been benchmarking this to the BMW 4.4 liter. That's in the 5 Series. That's kind of our benchmark for this application. That comes in about 228, so we're 17 kilograms lighter than that BMW 4.4 liter.
Okay.
So that's about 465 pounds, I think, if I did my math correctly.
Yeah. VRM Chris asks, how is the CTS V Sport with the twin turbo to drive? I guess we're going to have to wait and find out, huh?
Yeah.
This is not a wet sump engine, is it?
Yes, it is. There is no dry sump in this.
Okay. Yeah, Jonathan Brown was just saying, is this a wet sump engine? Yes, it is.
No, back on the drive, though, it is very exciting to drive.
I would imagine.
You know, emphasizing on how we set up this torque curve and this power band on this, we think creates a really exciting product to drive.
And, you put a wing on the back?
Hold her down?
That's only if it's Audi TT shaped.
Yeah.
Scotty in Cleveland asks, on the new CTS, why did Cadillac call it a V Sport instead of just V? Well, the V Sport is a little sportier than the regular one, but not as radical as the V.
I think it's two cylinders less.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, clearly V has its own category, right? And this isn't going to get there. But it's better than the naturally aspirated. And I think thinking that through, that this is category worthy. There's some enough unique attributes with the powertrain, the ride and handling package that's going to be tied into that V Sport to go for that designation.
Olds 442 asks, is anyone surprised with Buick Encore sales performance?
No, not initially. Let's see what it's like in a year from now.
Yeah. When
everybody who wants one has one.
Yeah, it was a nice package, really was. The one thing about it that was less than ideal, I thought, were the seats. But
yeah,
it always seems to be a problem.
It won't have the legs of the Enclave, for example, which kept selling well years
into
it.
Yeah, it's going on 8 years or something. Yeah.
Here's one for you, Scott. Rum and Coke asks, does autonomous technology interfere with police radar? If so, where can I buy an autonomous car?
Acura RLX and the upcoming Mercedes S-Class have a little, what I'd call light autonomy, as well as the Infiniti Q50.
Well, that S-Class has got a bunch of things.
Well, yeah, but the it will steer itself on light turns for up to about 10 seconds, which is the same as the Acura
RLX. Can you text if you have an autonomous car?
Sure you
can. Lawyers are what's going to keep autonomous cars off the road. I mean, at the end of the day, who's liable for something is what's going to stop that.
I drove one at Continental on its off-road, and not on public roads in Germany, and they're coming.
But it's a good question. Will it interfere with police radar?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Do you trust it, though? That's the thing, right?
Well, see, you know, if I was a ruler of the world, there would all the municipalities would save a bunch of money because I would ban radar.
But here's the other issue. If you have autonomous cars, the way autonomous cars are envisioned, you would at some point set the car to drive itself. It already reads the speed limit, and it wouldn't go faster than the speed limit anyway. But it's a moot point, basically.
Yeah, I would pull the radar out of the cars and just make the police just go back to the old pacing method.
Yeah.
And because everyone's going at least 10 over, so you can write everybody. Mm-hmm. But it would save a lot of money. So
save us a lot of money, not the municipalities.
Yeah. So Ray Schaefer asks, I'd like to hear the panel's opinion as to why Ford never felt the need to offer a more direct competitor for the Chevy Corvette. And in your opinion, right move or wrong?
Goes back to the Thunderbird. But the Thunderbird came out before the Corvette, came out before the Corvette became a serious sports car, still had a six-cylinder engine.
Right.
And Thunderbird did well as a Boulevardier, and especially when they added two seats and made it bigger. So.
Yeah, I would argue that there are two iconic American names, Mustang and Corvette. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're different. Mustang is the soul of the Ford Motor Company, and the Corvette should be of General Motors, mm-hmm. but it goes from one varying degree to the other. But those are the two magic nameplates. The new Mustang's coming, and
you could argue that the GT500 and some of those other cars were kind of had Corvette in its sights, but it never was a Corvette. Nobody ever compared those two cars.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have the Viper, but you know, the Viper, compared to the longevity of the Corvette, I mean, the Viper's got a long way to go.
And, it does.
Yeah. So let's see, what else? There's a lot of questions in here. I'm trying to get one for you, Rich. Something that will stump you.
A couple at the top. You may need to refresh, Peter.
Yeah, I've been refreshing. George from Brooklyn is asking, is Cadillac developing diesels to expand the brand into non-U.S. markets? Maybe.
Are there any non-U.S. diesel Cadillacs right now?
Non-U.S. diesel Cadillacs? I don't think so.
Yeah. So, yes.
There's only one way to go. It all kind of depends on... Yeah. And then for the U.S., it depends on how the Chevy Cruze diesel... Right.
Here's one for Rich that he can't answer. Chuck Grancy wants to know, will the twin turbo 3.6 transfer to other GM divisions?
Yeah.
Can't comment on that.
Is the 3.6 in any other GM divisions?
Oh, sure. Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, GMC.
Could you see this at any point as a crossover or even a truck engine? And I'm thinking, when I say truck, I mean... like Escalade.
Yeah. It can work in a lot of applications, right? There's nothing that we designed into it that precludes it from doing other things, right? Where it goes, and it's going to be driven by marketing, what we think we should do.
Packaging-wise, it's a pretty small engine, too. I mean...
especially for a dual overhead cam turbo.
Turbo, yeah.
I mean, it's deep, but it's certainly not very wide.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Had we started with a bigger package, right, we might have come up with a bigger engine, right? But here we went into a very tight package with this, and so that's going to lend itself into a lot of other applications if it had to do that.
Here's a question for all of us. Is the Mercedes-Benz CLA sedan the smartest thing that Mercedes has done in years?
I've driven it. I'd say it's fairly smart.
Did you drive the AMG?
No, I did not. I haven't driven the AMG. I did the initial, the CLA 250. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to do fairly well. what happens when the Audi A3 sedan comes along. I'm not sure. But, it's smart and it's not. It's just expanding the line so much.
Well, Mercedes has never been shy about chasing after niches no one's ever thought about. And
getting down into commodity cars and kind of touching the edge of what's luxury and what's not.
I remember having a conversation with Dieter Zetsche once about that. You know, it was about they walked away from engineered like no other car in the world and to become more approachable.
Yeah.
And I expressed to Dieter that I thought it was a bad idea. He said, well, what's wrong with that, Peter? We have Mercedes in every niche in Germany. I said, yeah, but that's Germany. You've just spent 20 years establishing engineered like no other car in the world. And that's when they were coming out with that, what was that? That little coupe, that compressor coupe.
That was their worst car.
Yeah, the C220.
It was the C-Class sport coupe, I think they called it. It was a hatchback.
So, and I think it all comes down to branding, and you know, this will be a big test with the CLA. I actually think it'll really take from other Mercedes sales.
I think the big loser in the CLA is the E.
Could be.
And the reason why is that people buy the E because they don't want to buy the base C. So now the CLA is below the C, so now that they're justified to buy the C class.
Here's a question for you, Rich. Why, from Troy.
All right.
Why didn't Cadillac just offer the normally aspirated 6.2-liter V8 in the CTS instead of going to the expense of developing the 3.6 turbo? Mm.
Because twin turbo just sounds so much nicer. This comes from the V6 assistant chief engineer.
Yeah, exactly.
Gordon Lee might have told you something different.
It's the future, isn't it? Fewer cylinders. Breathed on.
Right. Clearly there's market drivers here, right, that are pushing manufacturers into turbocharging technology. Some for downsize boost for fuel economy. Others for performance plays. We think there's a market there. That's why we're going.
In cars, V8s have lost their luster. I mean, Buick doesn't have a V8. And other than performance within GM, on the car side, there's no just standard V8 that comes with a car anymore.
Trucks, Corvettes, and Vs, that's it.
Yeah,
the SS, yeah. Trucks, Corvettes, V-Series.
The younger buyers, I'm sure, don't care.
I still care about a V8, but that's just me.
They sound so nice.
They do.
They do.
They do. I think there's going to be a home for a V8 for a long time.
Yeah.
It'll be around for a long time, just not in volume.
Yep.
So Youngblood in Cleveland is asking me this. In recent ALMS races, the Mazda Sky Active Diesel GX class has claimed victory over the Porsche Cayman Fluke or earned. Well, actually, it's Grand Am. And, you know, let's face it, the Grand Am is owned by the France family, and the France family, if there's a manufacturer interested in showcasing a product, they will find a class for it. They didn't have one for the Mazda Sky Active Diesel, so they invented one. Not to take anything away from the people at Mazda, you know, it's a nice diesel, but let's face it, they created the class for Mazda, and there's one competitor against the diesel, and it's a Porsche Cayman. So I think
It's an interesting class.
Yeah, it's an interesting class. GX, it's aptly named. They should just say it's experimental class for whatever manufacturer needs to be accommodated. So let's see. Flash to Pass asks, I see Caddy now has $3,000 cash on the ATS. Are sales that bad, or are they trying to hit some higher sales numbers? You just never know.
Rich, that's a marketing question.
Yeah, that's not for you, Rich. That's just, that's for us. And it just depends on what they're doing.
It could be local.
It could be local. It could be, you know, here's the thing. I mean, right now, GM's got a problem. Until the new CTS comes out, the ATS and the CTS are right, you know, within a couple grand of each other.
Right.
Now, the reason they made the CTS bigger is so, you know, there will be a clear ladder when you go into a Cadillac dealer, you go to the ATS, and the CTS is dramatically bigger. Whereas now, they've got a problem, but that'll be gone once the new CTS comes in the market. You know, they will fix the pricing thing.
Make a big difference, not only in price, but also in size. The CTS was a tweener car, it grows into a true E-class size competitor with the new CTS, with the 2014 model.
Jonathan Brown, last question for you, Rich. Does the twin turbo V6 and the XTS come with a 6 or 8 speed? I think it's just 6.
Yeah, it's a 6 speed all-wheel drive transmission.
Okay. And, you know, this is a good time to bring the proceedings to a halt. I'd like to thank our guest, Rich Bartlett. Really appreciate it, Rich. Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
One of the true believers in the business, which we like to have these people on because they're the people who are in the trenches doing the work. And I'm sure Rich has a team of people that he works with. We appreciate it. Todd Lasseter from Automobile. Thank you, Todd. It's always a pleasure.
Peter, thanks for having me.
And Scott Burgess from Motor Trend. Scott, always a pleasure. So you can read our stuff at, Todd, where can they read you?
AutomobileMag.com and at Automobile Magazine.
And what about the blog you do?
I call it the Motor City Blog Man. It's at AutomobileMag.com.
Okay. And Scott?
MotorTrend.com. And you can follow me at Autocritic on Twitter.
Oh, yep. And I'm at AM_Lassa at Twitter.
Okay.
Not as elegant as Scott's name.
And, of course, you can get my stuff at AutoExtremist.com, and I'm on Twitter, but I'm on with my name because there was a rogue element trying to get my stuff. So I'm Peter M. DiLorenzo at Twitter. And AutoExtremist is on Facebook. It has a presence there. I don't really get involved in it.
I'm also on Vine. What else? Facebook.
Vine. okay.
I'm learning about Waz.
Yeah.
And a couple of other things.
And, of course, you can friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. And you can follow the global empire of Autoline on Twitter, twitter.com/Autoline. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in yet again. And we really appreciate you joining us. And we'll see you all next week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at Autoline.tv.